My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.
I am Iron Man. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Post Credit Podcast. I am your host, Eric Italiano, senior writer at BroBible.com. Today, as always, I am joined by my co-host, Cade Onder, who you could find at comicbook.com, writing about video games. We're also joined by our halfway house midwife of a co-host, Brandon Katz, who has been on the show.
I love that description.
Yeah, that was, I was literally thinking about how to start this show today. And it's like, you're not a co-host, you're not a host, but you've been here for, I don't know, almost six straight weeks. So like, I've got to figure out something to call you. So Perfect. You're now like the halfway house.
You know what? It's not the worst nickname I've ever had in my life.
Who you could find over at Parrot Analytics, telling entertainment companies what to show and give us. This, right, Brandon? Is that a sort of a fair assumption of what you do?
Yeah, more or less. You know, I'm helping advise studios and entertainment companies on like what to invest in and what strategies to do, and working with fellow media members and getting them cool data to talk stories about. So, you know, a lot of different things.
Yep. So we've got a plant on the inside, y'all.
There we go.
All right. And the show, as I should say, is consisted of two guys who have had a public interaction with The Rock on Twitter and one loser who has not.
I don't even know why we have to bring other people down.
It was very cool to see that today, Eric.
Cade, as you know that I think and feel, and I've said on this show, you were at a remarkable place for your age, and that's a total joke. If you don't follow me or Brandon on Twitter, a few years ago, Brandon had an awesome interaction with The Rock where he made a bet about what film?
It was a couple of his different films and what, you know, box office levels they would reach. Just long story short, I had pointed out some box office stats about how consistent The Rock is commercially. And I tagged him in it, not thinking anything of it. And he responds like, wow, I didn't even know about that. So let's make a bet for the next couple films. If my movie reaches that benchmark that I had pointed out, then I'll buy you a bottle of tequila. And I said, absolutely. You know, if it doesn't, I'll donate the equivalent amount to a charity. And so, you know, both of those bets hit. I still donated to charity because I'm a good guy. And no, the Rock made good. And this was before he had his own company, but he sent me.
It was before he was doling out bottles of his own stuff for free.
Yeah. So he sent me over some Don Julio, which was pretty good. And you know, the Rock's a man of his word, and he's a good dude.
So this past week, I saw a few of the people that I respect very highly in this business had the Black Adam junket over the weekend. I had reached out to Warner Bros. In late September, and they told me that I had missed the boat and was too late. So that's my fault. I'm going to take that one. And now I've learned, and I'm going to reach out sooner. So today, doing the same thing as Brandon did, I just kind of posted on Twitter saying, hey, I'm bummed that I missed out on the chance to speak to The Rock. I've been a fan for, I don't know, since the year 1999 at this point. I mean, literally before Cade was born. Yeah. And I posted a photo of me wearing one of his WWF, not EF, branded shirts from at least 2001 or two. And The Rock responded and said he's going to get me into the UK junket that is coming up in the next few days and or weeks. So keep an eye out for our interview with The Rock coming soon. Now that that is out of the way, let's get into some of our main topics of the week. As I said, there's no news, but we are going to check in with She-Hulk. As promised, we would do so when Daredevil finally made his appearance. He did so in episode 8, Cade?
Yeah, real quick, do you want to talk about the Marvel delays?
No, because we don't have to. They're always doing that shit.
Sure, yeah.
And I'll keep that in. That was us talking about the Marvel delays.
Good. Got it covered.
There you go. Settled.
Yes, it was right, episode 8.
Cade, I would like to think of you as the biggest Daredevil fan on this podcast, so yeah. I would also like you to lead this part of the conversation.
Sure thing. So we all knew Daredevil would be in this show. It was leaked a long time ago, and then he was obviously in the trailer. And he finally made his debut in the, I think they call it the penultimate episode, is the word.
Oh,
the biz,
right. It's just 9. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so he is now here, and it seems like this will probably be his only appearance because he's going back to New York now. But he shows up to defend the guy who's making all the suits for all the superheroes because someone's, what's his name, Leapfrog, his jet boots catch on fire or something. And so Daredevil, obviously having his suit made by this guy, comes to defend him, and crosses paths with She-Hulk, and it was just great to see him. It was just great to see
Matt. Hey, Murdock. Buddy.
Yeah, just like
long time no see.
I mean, really, what, like, it's just like, oh yeah, he's still got it. Like, it's like not a moment has passed. He's got his like low cadence, and he comes in all matter of fact, but still a little more elevated than normal.
You're in on is what I would call, because Matt Murdock has been in the MCU, yes, but this is Daredevil's first proper MCU bout. So do you think that they sort of struck the right balance and tone here? Or
yeah, I think so. Like, Daredevil cracks a little bit of jokes in the Netflix series. Like, it's a little more edgier, and it's a little more like no one else is really laughing when he cracks a joke, but like it's still, it has some fun to it. And Daredevil in the comics and every other piece of media is a little light. He's not like, ooh, Catholicism and stuff like
right. I mean, are any of them in fucking Marvel except the villains at this point? Punisher, maybe,
yeah,
since
he's probably the only murderer, one. But, yeah, but
I don't see Punisher lighting up like an open mic night.
No. And Daredevil's like quips are not like, uh-oh, like he's right behind me, isn't he? Like that, you know, stereotype. Like, he's just like, you tried to whoop my ass. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. And he's a little more smiley, and I think it's because he's in love, kind of. But seeing him show up as Matt Murdock was great. And then when we see him as Daredevil flipping around, doing cool shit, like the parking garage starts to like crack underneath his feet, and he does something to catch himself and then like flip himself back up. I thought that was awesome. And then the hallway fight makes a return, as always, trademark Daredevil thing now. And, you know, he's not making people bleed necessarily, but he's whipping ass. And
well,
I was
it
like,
was a wink and nod subversion. I wouldn't right. say it necessarily returned. Now, B, you said you tweeted that this is your third favorite Disney Plus series, fourth favorite.
Honestly, can't even remember what I put in the rankings, but I really like
High. Hi.
I really, really like She-Hulk. And, you know, to echo what Cade's saying, I loved Daredevil's introduction here. I thought the chemistry between the actors and characters was phenomenal. It was twofold, because both Jen and Matt Murdock as kind of legal opponents verbally sparring had great chemistry. And then both She-Hulk and Daredevil had amazing chemistry, both in their kind of friendly rivalry type of fight. So I just thought it was sparkling, kind of the dialogue, the feel. It was sexy, you know, it was funny. I really was into it.
So probably I agree.
My favorite episode of the whole season so far.
Yeah.
But like, cool is though. That the problem though?
No, because I really like it. I think it's been really enjoyable and humorous throughout. And I love how they're kind of giving us a really straight sitcom. You know, it's not really a Marvel show.
Yeah, I don't think it's like because Daredevil, right? Like, I think that's like an added factor.
Come on.
It's like he's a great addition.
At the end of the day, she's not fucking some random guy. She's fucking Daredevil. Yeah, that's what makes it fun.
It is. But it's consistent with the rest of the show, in my opinion. It's not like the whole show has been like, oh, come on, get Daredevil. It's like, it's like a cherry on top of an already great show. Like, I've been very vocal. I don't think that Disney Plus shows are very good, but this show has been
I think a lot of people have as well, to be honest.
So, so to have something that I'm like, I enjoy tuning into this, and it doesn't feel like a fucking chore to watch.
It doesn't.
Daredevil show up is like, oh, it's like I'm rewarded for enjoying something. It's just like, it's great.
So just on the topic of tone, when I saw the trailer or like the teaser released prior to when this dropped, featuring that scene of him showing up and doing the flips, I was very worried, because it was pretty jarring, because you don't have the context of Matt Murdock and what's her real name? Jen's interaction prior to that. So going in, I was like, oh man, they have really sort of cut our boy at the knees here and made him sort of like the classic sort of jokey, funny, haha MCU hero. With the added context of their previous flirtation, it totally made more sense.
Yeah.
So I'm in on the tone in that part. But is that the Daredevil show that I want to see? No. Is that the Daredevil show that I expect to see? Of course not. Which I think makes it more impressive that they're showing versatility in the way that Daredevil is going to be perhaps used. Now, that doesn't mean I think the interpretation is perfect. I think the gold-tinged suit is horrible.
Yeah, I'm not.
I think that, and I understand that it's a comic-based thing, but I think, B?
Oh, no, yeah, that suit sucks. I was just shaking my head. I've always been someone, I've said it in this pod a million times, I don't care about like comic accurate suits. Yeah. I think there's a reason they change most of them, because most of them look ridiculous. And yeah, sometimes it is cool seeing comic accurate, like, oh, wow, that's what I grew up with. But at the end of the day, like more often than not, I'm like, that's really silly and doesn't really seem to fit when you translate mediums.
Exactly. And so my disagreement with it is not so much the literal color of it, but the character that's wearing it. Daredevil is the only Batman-esque character in the MCU where he could pop up behind you in total silence and you shit your pants. Mm-hmm. And that should be a very terrifying experience. But seeing him do it, and in the hallway scene, they use sort of a very aggressive blue lighting, so it's nullified, which I guess fixes the problem a bit. Mm-hmm. But I just think it makes what is supposed to be an inherently, if not terrifying, like, I mean, the name Devil is in his name. So there is supposed to be an element of fear. His nickname is the Man Without Fear. Fear is incorporated into his whole pathos. So for him to look like Ronald McDonald in a superhero costume, I think is so incongruent with what the character should be. And there's a reason that the comic book artist changed his suits over the years. It undercuts what makes the character effective. And I'm going to be fascinated to see if the suit remains in the show. So let's talk about the hallway fight in general. I thought it was I haven't really decided if it's a clever subversion or a pulling out the rug from under beneath me yet. How did y'all feel about the quote unquote hallway scene, which if you guys don't know, is an homage to every Daredevil season 1 through 3 had sort of a one take of Daredevil taking on multiple opponents in a narrow hallway. She-Hulk did that a bit, but then when they squared up the camera to be like, all right, we're doing it. She-Hulk comes crashing in. So Cade, B, thoughts?
I liked it enough. Like I didn't feel like I was robbed of anything, because I didn't go in expecting that. Like, you know, like I'm like, that's a Daredevil thing, not a She-Hulk thing. So I was like, to tease it a little bit and be like, we know what you want, and maybe this isn't the place to do it. Like, I feel like Marvel is aware, right? And they're probably going to do that in the actual show. And that's fine by me. I didn't mind She-Hulk crashing into the ceiling and just fucking slamming these guys to the floor. But I think just generally speaking, in terms of his action, like, he's going around just like kicking people in the face and just like hitting them really hard. And I'm like, and you're still working in like the layers of like a pretty soft PG-13 in terms of the action. Yeah. So, and I can't imagine they have like really good fight choreographers on this show, just based on what we've already seen. Like that episode where those like big bat things are flying around, just like flinging them around. So I'm not like expecting the best of the best here. But they seem to be aware people want to see Daredevil whipping ass and like in an effective manner. And so that's enough for me to hear that message.
Yeah, I think it's fan service done well. It's a wink and a nod.
Which you love.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I think I don't like fan service in general. I think it has to be done.
Right. No, I'm saying you love it specifically when it's done well.
Yeah, and I think it's very well modulated, because like I said, it's a wink and a nod to something we all know without even remotely trying to approach or top or copy or duplicate what had come before. Because they're like, listen, we get it. This mm-hmm. is awesome. This is intrinsic to the character. We're not even going to make the attempt here. But, you know, you can get a nice little laugh at it. And there can be a nice character dynamic interplay within that joke between She-Hulk and Daredevil. So I think it was done really well. And, you know, I'm not necessarily watching She-Hulk for the action.
Yeah.
And I fully expect Daredevil Born Again.
But you just said the Daredevil episode was your favorite one.
Yeah, but that has nothing to do with the fight scenes necessarily. Okay. Like I really like these, but
okay.
It was my favorite because of like the character building, the relationships, the huge sense of humor, not because like, oh, you know, they tag team some goons or henchmen as the debate raged on.
So I think the next big point is, and Cade, you and I both sent out tweets about this. B, you may well have, but I didn't catch it. Superheroes are fucking in the MCU. It's back. I think that this is the sexiest scene in the MCU since Winter Soldier, where Scarlett Hansen and Chris Evans are on the escalator. And that was, what, 2014? Mm-hmm. So it's been a long... And I'd also say 2014 is also the year that Guardians of the Galaxy 1 came out. And right. Chris Pratt's Star-Lord like literally woos Gamora throughout the course of that film. But I think since then, romance and sex has largely been MIA from the MCU as a whole. I enjoyed it, A, because it's just fun, right? Like, we're all adults here. It is most adults' primary goal in life, other than like paying the bills and like, other than like, you know, having a job and surviving, like you're probably thinking about sex. So I think the acknowledgement of it is, and then we'll talk about Werewolf at Night next, but I think that, you know, these sort of, after a year of people really thinking, yo, is the MCU on its way to being washed? Like, are we watching a once star QB in his last final days? But in a weird way, some of their more low-key projects, She-Hulk, Werewolf by Night, have shown a creativity that made the franchise great in the first place. And as Neanderthal-esque as it may be, the basic acknowledgement of sex is that for me. I'm like, oh, wow. They're acknowledging that not only are these adults, but all of them are remarkably attractive and they want to fuck each other. And I just think that that is just such a, do I expect that to be a theme that they carry across all films and all shows? Of course not. But I do appreciate them finally starting to pick and choose their spots and understand that maybe we can make a few shows. Like, if Moon Knight was an adult show, it would have fucking ripped. But the problem with that was they tried to split the line too much. But She-Hulk is fucking, Werewolf by Night was a legit horror project. So I find that to be encouraging signs.
Yeah. I mean, if you have superheroes around each other all the time and they have their own problems that no one else can relate to, eventually you're going to, you know, embrace each other in some capacity.
Especially with the comic origins of all the romances and marriages that exist.
Love is a major part of comic books. They are big soap operas, right?
Right, and, exactly.
So to see that really leaning into that is just great. I like you said, it's just a maturity thing. Like, it sounds juvenile to be like, oh, I want to see sex, but no, it really is embracing maturity and being like, yeah, this is not necessarily just like
we don't need to see them fuck.
No,
but the implication that they did is enough. Yeah.
You want to see them really handle their characters with the layers and depth, like that they have emotions, and emotions include horniness. And so that's important.
At the end of the day, if there's a contingent of very vocal, loud fans out there begging to see an uncle and his niece hook up on Game of Thrones, then why can't two appropriately non-related adults in the MCU hook up? Like, this shit is a no-brainer. And the only saving grace of like Wonder Woman 2 is the unbelievable chemistry between Chris Pine and Gal Gadot and their characters. And to see that dynamic really, really developed and emphasized more in the superhero genre, I'm all for it.
All right, so let's try to keep this last one to a yes or no, since I love this thought from Cade. Do you think Daredevil representing other superheroes is going to be a part of his own show? Cade?
Yes.
Oh, all right, B, yes. Cade, and since this was your thought, if you want to expand on it a bit.
We already saw him representing Spider-Man, and that's kind of where I was like, that's really interesting. And then we saw it here a little bit. So I think there's a chance now that he's part of the MCU and is not just limited to Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, and Iron Fist. I think there's a good chance that, I mean, who's in New York? Doctor Strange. Who else is alive? I don't know.
I mean, I don't think it really matters where they are, since we just saw him travel across the country.
Yeah. So I think there's a good chance. And New York is a big battleground for the MCU. So you could just argue like, oh, it's in their jurisdiction or whatever. So I'm not a lawyer, but I think there's a good chance that does happen. Yeah.
All right. So I kind of agree. I think that She-Hulk has been, and I said this at the start, and I think it remains true. As a sitcom, I'm enjoying it. As a Marvel product, and this is sort of like cognitive dissonance. I don't know what I want from the MCU because of my own expectations and because of what they've given me over the last 15 years, and it's just become such a muddled mess. But I just know that as an MCU product, She-Hulk is not doing it for me. But I am able to observe and judge these shows outside of that framework. And as a sitcom and as a TV show, I think it's fine. So moving on to something quite different, literally because it's the first time that Marvel has ever done one, is Werewolf by Night. It's sort of a 55-minute longer than a short film, shorter than a film. And I've already shared a lot of my thoughts on this podcast since I interviewed some of the talent behind the show. So I would love to hear Kate and B's thoughts. If you guys have any general feelings that you want to share, and then we'll dive into sort of some more nitpicky stuff.
I mean, Michael Giacchino has long been one of the best composers in Hollywood. He's probably first became most famous for Lost, of which that soundtrack still, oh, to this day, it's perfection, perfection. So I've long been a fan of Michael Giacchino, and to see him make his, what I believe is his directorial debut, his quote unquote feature directorial debut, even though we know it's not exactly feature length. I thought he knocked it out of the park. I think the major criticism I have of Werewolf by Night is that it's simply not long enough. And so the main character doesn't really get much of an arc that more so belongs to the female lead that he kind of teams up with.
But don't you think that that's the point? They would never make this as a film. Aren't you accounting for that?
Yeah, but I also think that this originally was supposed to be longer, and some behind the scenes drama, you know, ultimately resulted in it being very, very short and punchy. But listen, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I would like to see a little bit more exploration next time. But, you know, this was great. It was so cool to kind of adopt this otherworldly noir style. I think the color and the direction was great, really, really effective. And I think that MCU special presentation is a great platform for, you know, quote unquote, Elseworlds, elsewhere stories, whatever the tag is for when DC tells kind of non-canonical stories. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a great use. I mean, what if adjacent almost in that way? Yep. So it's pretty cool. And again, this also expands the MCU's corners. I mean, Eric, you and I have talked about it. There was kind of ground level. There was cosmic. There was mystic. Now we've got like martial arts. We've got a little bit more of like the horror and spiritual from Moon Knight. And this kind of delves into that. Yeah, monsters and horror. So I think every time you can add a new vertical, to put it in media terms,
right,
into the MCU, it's usually a worthwhile endeavor.
Now, Cade, quick, just before you share your thoughts, I had said when I saw the first teaser, I was like, there's no way that they're going to keep this tone. And then they do. And I think that the perfect epitome of that is when the Marvel Studios banner is unfolding and they do that sort of old school horror scare intercut with it. That's just such a tiny detail that I don't want to turn into a mountain, but I just think it is the perfect type of, like, if the MCU is a vodka soda, this is like the lime, right? It just adds that bit of spice, that bit of taste to a very bland, not bland in a bad way, bland and just like it's an easy to put down way. So, Cade, your general thoughts on it?
That was really cool. I think everyone knows I'm really into horror as a whole, and I really like weird horror. And this is kind of like, I mean, it's Marvel, so you know, it's not like Barbarian, but
like it wasn't scary.
No, but it's like, oh yeah, some guys doing like a monster hunt, and like they're like cultish and weird, and I'm like, this is cool. This is what I would like and what I would expect from something like this. It does kind of remind me of like old school like Disney Channel original movies with like a little more of an edge in some way. And I really enjoyed that. I will say, like, the aesthetic of trying to make it like an old like 1930s 40s horror movie doesn't quite land the way I want it to. I know some people have really praised it for that, but like when you have the black and white and music and stuff, and then you have everyone doing these cool like flips and whatever, like Black Widow, I'm like, this takes me out. Like I don't get, the aesthetic doesn't match the actual filmmaking that's happening. And it I don't want to say it feels like an afterthought, but it does feel.
So do you think that you would have preferred it if it was in color?
I don't even know if it's that. I just would have liked them to like, and it's hard because you're making something in the MCU still, but like, I would have preferred them to just kind of make it a little more like stilted. And I get that's like a really weird stylistic choice. That's one hard to pull off. And two, is going to be something that pisses
people off. No, but I get it. They're trying to make a 1930s, 40s horror film, yeah. but the set piece techniques are clearly exactly. Modern.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's, and especially when you show stuff like that weird, like animatronic, like mummy thing that they have at the beginning. So it kind of felt like, oh, they are kind of really trying to use like real practical effects and really trying to lean into that stuff. And so that stuff didn't really work for me, but again, I appreciate the whole premise. I think it's good. And that's more nitpicky, but I did like it.
So I want to do a quick role playing game. You guys are an up and coming Marvel exec, and you've been asked to sit in the post Werewolf by Night meeting. And Kevin Feige turns to you and he asks for a sentence or a paragraph about what we should learn from this. What do you say?
There's room for non-traditional stories if approached from the right angle and given to talented filmmakers.
Comics as a whole have multiple genres, and by trying to connect everything all together, you lose the variety and creativity. And this shows that you can really lean into that and do something special.
And then for me, I would say, given the streaming age that we're in, there is no need to adhere to a 30-minute long sitcom or a 2-hour long movie. We could do whatever the fuck we want.
Or 6 episodes for every damn series.
Right, exactly. That is the bottom line here. All right. And then finally, I just am curious, any characters that you would like to see feature in a special presentation, which executive producer Brian Gay told me that they're going to do more of. I'll start off. I think basically any non-Mount Rushmore X-Men would be great, because those are a lot of characters to just introduce in a film. So to give them all each their sort of hour-long prologue, I think would be a great idea. And then one that I say every time that we talk about something related to what character deserves their own unique story, Dr. Doom, because I want a true anti-hero film in the MCU. Credit to DC. That's what they appear to be trying to do with Black Adam. Based on the clips that we've seen, it seems like it's going to be Black Adam first, the JSA, and then they'll eventually team up and fight some greater threat. But I want the MCU to do that. While I have my doubts that they will do a Dr. Doom film, a Dr. Doom special presentation that serves as either a prequel or sequel to Fantastic Four to sort of give him his own runway into his eventual massive MCU villain role, I think would be great.
I don't know. Maybe like Howard the Duck. Like, I don't know. That'd be just like cool. Just give it a shot. See what you can do.
Right? And just silly and fun. Yeah.
You got the runway to it. But the thing that came to my mind when I saw your prompt was like, there's a comic book where Deadpool kills the entire Marvel universe. And that would just be like, fuck it. Like, it doesn't matter, right? Just do it. And
yeah,
bring back all these actors for like a 5-minute scene where they just get murked by Ryan Reynolds. And that'd be sick.
That's a great call.
That does sound fun. I obviously, this character is going to be introduced in a future film within this franchise because they're too big not to. But I would love to see a Silver Surfer special presentation when he's off Earth, not interacting with the Fantastic Four, but he's being the herald for Galactus and visiting other worlds and doing some crazy cosmic stuff that we can't really comprehend. That also might be like too odd and too esoteric and also too removed from MCU proper to be like its own show or its own movie plot. But, you know, a quick little hour, 15 minute jog with Silver Surfer as he surfs across the intergalactic highways. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
All right. And we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be breaking down House of the Dragon, Episode 8, The Lord of the Tides.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, and we are back discussing House of the Dragon, Episode 8, The Lord of the Tides B. I have got to be honest, I have been stoked to talk about this with you all week, because I have rewatched this episode, I don't know, 3 or 4 times, and this I truly consider to be one of the best Game of Thrones hours that I've seen. I think that it marks a high point for this series in and of itself. So before we dive in, do you have any sort of general thoughts that you want to share?
Yeah, I am going against the majority here. I mean, your opinion is shared by most across the film Twitterverse. I really, other than Viserys in this episode, which I know we'll get to, I thought this was so much more of the same and almost a built-in excuse for there to be another time jump that doesn't really leave us in any different position than we already were in, particularly as it goes to the factioning of the family. So, I enjoyed it, but I was a little let down, and I was surprised to see the overwhelming outpour of love, but excited to talk about it.
Wow. I did not expect that take, especially considering what you quote tweeted of my tweet. I thought like, oh, wow, we're on the same page here. So I'm glad to hear that we'll kind of split a bit. All right, let's dive into our beat by beat breakdown. After Lord Corlys suffered a grave, but not yet fatal. And I find it interesting that they're like, he's dying, but he ain't dead, right?
Because we're not showing him.
Yeah, I'm sure that it's not going to play out as simply as they would all hope. So after Lord Corlys suffered a grave, but not yet fatal wound, his brother Vaemond protests to Princess Rhaenys that he should be the heir to Driftmark because Rhaenyra's kids aren't true Valyrian. Meanwhile, Daemon, retrieving a new dragon egg from the dragon's secret maternity ward, receives word from his former whore that Viserys is on the verge of death. So he and Rhaenyra, with their sons, go back to King's Landing with the intention of getting Viserys to give Driftmark to Lucerys. Man, the semantical clerical errors in this family are just exhausting. I'm tired just saying those same letters over and over again.
And also just in the scope of storytelling, how often do you think we'll ever be able to say the words secret dragon maternity ward?
Right. And I love the way that they show like how sort of secretive knowledge. Like, I don't even think most Targaryens know how to get there. The shaft that Daemon has to climb down to get there is like a life or death situation.
And, I mean, with all the time jumps too, this dude's got to be in his 40s, right?
Yeah. 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 Right? Because we've seen at least 15 years of time. We've seen at least 15 years of time jumps.
This dude's, you know, treacherous.
All right. So I think that my main takeaway from this is, and we've talked about this a few times on the show, is that the choice to make the Valyrians black, I think, was so smart, because this makes the idea of the crown being like, nah, sorry, this is ours now, and this is how we're doing shit, like, makes it that more poignant, right? Like, and Vaemond says it in a later scene, but he's like, just because you fucked your house up and did what you wanted doesn't mean that I'm going to let you do the same to mine. And it sucks because I agree with Vaemond in principle, but because of the societal and legal structure of the world that he lives in, him telling the truth is a death sentence.
Big time. And I mean, I'm sure we'll get to this scene. It's just his stupidity bothered me.
So we talked about Daemon's sort of quest to get the dragon eggs. Based on your book knowledge, based on your show knowledge, who currently, as far as you know, has the dragon advantage, as far as you can tell? Because last week, Team Green just landed the biggest dragon in the realm, whose name escapes me. All three of the Alicent Targaryen kids have their own dragons. We know that Daemon has his dragon, Rhaenyra has his dragon. So who in your mind currently has the edge?
Well, Rhaenys is on the sidelines kind of as this neutral party. So.
Is she though? Because she was pretty smug when Rhaenyra tried to make a deal and she was like, tomorrow the Hightowers land their first blow and you're fucked.
Yeah, but then we also, you know, she also comes around in terms of like the pack. So I think that helps. Then I'm not quite clear about Rhaenyra's Jack and Luke, Jace and Luke dragon abilities. So obviously, because earlier Luce and Jace made fun of Aemond for not having a dragon, which implies that they did have dragons.
Of course.
But we haven't actually seen them and their actual dragon. So I'm a little unclear about that right now.
Do you just think that that's them like a plot device of them lying or just bad?
No,
bad writing.
I'm assuming they have dragons and we just haven't really seen them.
Right.
But it seems to me that maybe Team Alicent, Team Hightower has the dragon advantage, but like I wouldn't.
So it's Team Green and Team Black.
But I also just wouldn't want to mess with Daemon and on top of a dragon. Like that seems to be like the MVP, even if the other bench is deeper.
I love when we turn the show into a vague sports show. All right, next major plot beat is Otto Hightower, my boy, attempts to convince Alicent to give Driftmark to Aemond before she's whisked away to deal with a maid that was raped by her son, Aegon. Alicent sympathizes and understands and believes the girl before giving her the plan BT. Alicent is, I would say, the most volatile character in this whole series, not in terms of her personality, but in terms of the way she can influence this entire civil war. Even before a dying Viserys confuses the shit out of her. She was such a crucial cog in this whole wheel. So I find her in the 6 years since we've seen her finding religion in the light of the seven, which based on what we saw of the power of the seven enthrones is kind of a low key, huge get, not a get, but it's like, if she's, I don't know if she's doing it for her own peace or if she's doing it for militaristic purposes, but the whole Red Keep being decked out in 7-point stars is no small thing.
Yeah. I mean, one, the, you know, the faith of the seven, just with like the maesters too, it's pretty much centered also in Old Town. Like there's a big power epicenter there. So it makes sense that the high towers are there. And two, I don't remember when it happens. I don't remember who did it. But in Game of Thrones, you know, Cersei arms the faith militant. And that obviously turns out to be a huge, huge, huge mistake. But they say within the show, it's the first time that the faith has been armed since so-and-so. And I know, like, of course, I've read about it from through the wikis and the books and everything. But I'm wondering, like, is it Allison and, you know, and her contingent that armed the faith for the first time ever? Because later then, obviously, they negotiate a de-arming in exchange for, I think, the Faith of the Seven becoming like the de facto country religion or something like that. And I'm thinking, like, if it is Allison, like, again, you're playing with fire, but huge, huge advantage if you can control them.
I mean, it strikes me as a very Chekhov's 7-pointed star to have the
7-pointed ninja star,
the queen and de facto king prominently featuring their gear. Like, I feel like that Allison's commitment to them or commitment to their ideals is going to come into play in a major way at some point. And yeah, let me just say, while the thought is on my mind, George R.R. Martin came out and said to, in order to do the House of the Dragon, aka the Fire and Blood story justice, he thinks it needs 4 seasons of 10 episodes each.
Yeah, to that point, in terms of the public branding, like, once you get sponsored by Coke, you can't get caught sipping a Pepsi. You know what I mean? Like, I think the images have to lead to action in a lot of ways. And even, let's just say, even if they're not militarized, it's still a huge political asset to have the faith on your side, particularly when, you know, the rest of the world outside the Targaryens are not huge fans of incest. Obviously, that kind of goes out the window when you look at Aegon marrying his sister. But still, you know,
that poor girl.
Seriously, she deserves better. So I think in terms of resources and assets and brain power, the green has a huge lead on the black. And, you know, Daemon's psychosis can only take you so far. Because Rhaenyra is not a plotter.
Now, B, based on your combination of distant, largely forgotten book knowledge and general Game of Thrones knowledge, in relation to my point about the Seven sort of being a huge player out there for someone to recruit to their side, are there any other big players that we could expect to see recruited for this war? Like, are the Starks, the Lannisters, the Greyjoys? I don't have the historical Game of Thrones. I know that the Starks generally tend to their own world up north, but I'm just using them as an example of, are there any other big mercenary houses out there that we're going to see folded into this?
So obviously I don't know how the show is going to do it, but like in every major conflict, there's always opportunistic individuals who want to join a faction with the ultimate goal of increasing their house's power, wealth, and prestige. Now, this is largely a Targaryen civil war, but obviously you do.
But they are the rulers of the crown. So by that logic, it is a fucking countrywide war.
And you need manpower to fight a civil war, even when it's just, you know, largely withheld to one house. So again, through the history of what I know, there are houses that get involved and there are collateral damage that gets swept up in all of this on both sides. Whether or not the show wants to make that a focal point or just like a passing, like, oh yeah, well,
in your gut.
I think it would make sense in season two to start expanding the world a little bit, not to the extent perhaps that Game of Thrones did, because at a certain point it was too far flung.
Well, because Game of Thrones was out to in, whereas this feels very much in to out.
Exactly. I mean, as we discussed, I think for the first episode, like one reason why it's so much easier to follow as opposed to Game of Thrones' pilot is because Game of Thrones was, I think, taking place across three major locations with about 12 main characters introduced in the first episode, something like that. Whereas this was largely King's Landing, largely four or five main characters. And that is largely kept true for the entire season. Yes, they've expanded a little bit out. With the time jumps, it's been a little bit hard to always keep track. But essentially, we're still dealing with the same core group of people in the same core area. And I think it does make sense, particularly as people die and everything, to start bringing in some power players from different elements of Westeros and beyond.
And then before we move on to the next major plot beat, I just want to say that the director of this episode confirmed that Alicent does not have Diana poisoned. So when she gives her the plan B tea, when Diana drinks it, gives her a very regretful, sorrowful look. And myself and a lot of people took that as, oh, wow, is she like killing her right here? The director confirmed that she's not. And that's just a regular plan B tea.
Yeah. And I just also want to point out quickly that, again, Allison's been put in a serious situation, and I did have sympathy for her earlier on, but she's essentially now gaslighting a rape victim of her sons to protect her family. Like, nobody is worth rooting for.
I took that as tough love to woman on woman. Like, she I might believe you in this private room of us two, but all the disgusting people out there are going to judge you based on hearsay. And I just took that as her giving her the hard truth. That girl expected the queen to have her like killed.
It doesn't matter what the expectations were. It doesn't matter if she's telling the truth, which she is. That is a true statement. What matters is she's saying it to ultimately make sure it stays in-house and to protect her family. And she has no.
But if she wanted the ultimate insurance, she'd just kill her. But she's too good to.
I'm not going to give her points for not killing an innocent rape
in the Game of Thrones world. Yeah, queen.
I'm not giving her points for that.
You're basing it on a scale of our society.
No, even back then, like you can handle things with a certain grace, and she has. She's basically mad at Aegon for exposing the family to potential criticism, not for him raping a girl.
I disagree entirely. She says you're no son of mine, not because of political goals, because she's disgusted by him.
I don't know. I think she's calcified on the throne, which is a commentary in and of itself.
Okay. All right. All right, moving on to the next big plot beat is Rhaenyra and Daemon reunite with Viserys for the first time in 6 years and introduce him to his namesake grandson while also telling him that he must reaffirm his position backing Lucerys as the heir of Driftmark. Alicent, fresh off of reaming Aegon for raping a poor girl, greets Daemon and Rhaenyra, who question her over Viserys' state and her role in the kingdom.
So I think that makes Daemon a funcle, because he's a father and an uncle to that kid all at the same time, right?
I'm not familiar with the ins and outs of incest family triage, but I'm just going to take you at your word for it.
I think he's a funcle. I think this is the start of Viserys's tour de force.
Dude, this is why I need you back on the show full time, because you just took the words out of my mouth. This is the starting point of what is, and we'll talk about this later. And I'm trying not to be a prisoner of the moment and recency bias, which you actually recently tweeted about, right?
Yes, sir. Just long story short, we are all guilty of it, myself included, but recency bias is really, really, really hard to shake. And when we talk about both strategies of entertainment companies that take a long time to play out, or we're ranking our favorite shows or movies in the MCU or what have you, we often are leaning towards the things that we most recently consumed or judging them and weighting them more heavily than we would the things that are farther off in our memory. And it's really hard to shake ourselves of that. Now, that does not mean, though, that in the case like this, it isn't warranted, because this is Viserys's flu game, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, while you struggle with recency bias, something that my head rubs against all the time, and we've talked about this, is confirmation bias.
Yeah.
Going into something knowing I love this character or I love this actor, and then my opinion being based off of that. So I went into this being a huge fan of Patty Considine from, The Outsider, from Hot Fuzz, from the litany of things I've seen him in.
You've been talking about long before this show.
Long before, because he is one of those Brendan Gleeson-esque English, Irish actors who aren't name brands, but whenever they pop up in something, you're like, fuck yeah. You're just like, fuck yeah. So him getting this role, this starring role in a Game of Thrones series, I always knew that, like, he's getting his due, right? It's about goddamn time. So confirmation bias aside, I think that this scene is, and you put it out in a great tweet, I wasn't in on the Viserys arc until they tied it up in a loop this week. I found it very disconnected and stop and start and distant, but the way that they wrapped it up this week crystallized the entire arc in such a way that I find Patty Considine's Viserys to be up there with one of the great all-time Thrones performances that we've ever seen. Some that come to mind are Dany, Stannis.
I mean, Peter Dinklage won 4 Emmys for Tyrion. He's got to be nominated. He has to be nominated.
So do you agree with the statement that Patty's season one run is up there with some of the greatest Game of Thrones performances that we've seen? And do you have any favorites that jump to mind?
I mean, Tyrion, Peter Dinklage is of course probably my favorite. I mean, Ned Stark did a great job. Arya, you know, Maisie Williams, a girl who never acted before Game of Thrones, just come in as one of the most naturalistic performers of all. I think Kit Harington starts a little wobbly and just vastly improves by the time we get to the end of Thrones. So there's a lot of really good performances out there. And I think within House of the Dragon, you know, Matt Smith's Daemon is the flashy character because he's all sneering, snide, you know, psychotic, chaotic energy. And
right. He's set up to be the sort of leading man, except for the intense murder and incest. You know, he's sort of the prototypical hero.
Exactly. But as George R. R. Martin has said, Patty Considine infuses Viserys with this tragic majesty that his book counterpart never had. And George R. R. Martin, I think, said today, too, or this weekend, he wants to go back and rip up the chapters and rewrite them now that he has Patty Considine's version in mind. And I think as much as I kind of, you know, have my issues with George R. R. Martin, there's probably no higher compliment than the creator himself being like, oh, you did better than
you
I did.
Fucking, you made this better. Yeah, absolutely. Now, so real quick,
he's got to be nominated.
Before we move on to the next stanza, Daemon mentions the Triarchy again. Now, last week I had asked you, is this some sort of White Walker-esque threat that's going to loom over the show? You had said that it's just going to be sort of a plot device to sort of inspire conflict within the main characters. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, if they ever did become such a huge threat and the Targaryens united, they have like 9 dragons. You know, you're just not winning against that. It's going to be a clean sweep. It's going to be San Antonio versus the Cleveland Cavaliers 4-0 championship.
Or the fucking Nets. That's back in the day. All right.
These are both dated references.
Yeah, right. We are now closing on 30. Sucks.
I am 30, man. It's horrible.
You are 30. You are 30. That sucks for you.
It's awful, dude. I hate it.
All right. Next stanza. Aemon trains with and beats Sir Criston while Rhaenyra attempts to make a bargain with Princess Rhaenys to solidify their power, and then also has a late night conversation with her father about the Song of Ice and Fire. Then we get to sort of the big set piece of the episode of the season. Determined to make things right, Viserys makes his way to the throne room, ending Otto's kangaroo court and bequeathing Driftmark to Lucerys. Daemon flips shit, calls Rhaenyra's kids bastard. Vaemond, who is Lord Corlys's brother, flips shit, calls Rhaenyra's kids bastards, and loses his head. B, this was, I know that I love something when I want to watch it over and over again and think about it and feel about it. And this entrance and this walk across the throne room and this speech from Patty Considine's Viserys was truly Shakespearean, right? It is legitimately one of the most emotional and stirring moments I could remember in the last 10 plus years of Thrones. It is a man poisoned by this very room and this very seat, making one last pained on the edge of his life trip through that very space in order to save his own family. And I was just not on the verge of tears. Game of Thrones has never made me cry. But if there was ever a thematic motif that got me close, it's this, man.
Shed tears when Brienne was knighted in the last season. Okay. I absolutely shed tears in
okay.
that.
Okay, great. And, great shout.
And so I think the walk is great. The moment with Daemon is just so well earned.
Improvised, this time. Yeah. By the way.
Completely mistake that he dropped the crown. It just turns out to be such a great moment. I think it's undercut a little bit by how absolutely idiotic Vaemond is, particularly being Corlys's brother. Corlys, who's someone who's navigated not only the seas, but the choppy waters of politics quite well overall.
But let me just say, isn't the literal walk across the room long enough? There's enough breathing space between those two?
Yeah, that's a great moment. But then, you know, I like his speech at the dinner table more than I like this. But yeah, that walk, the man mustering courage to defend is what he thinks is right. Oh, God, it is, as George R. R. Martin said, is tragic majesty. And I think he's got to know deep down this is the last time he'll sit the throne.
Now, you aren't. So you took the sort of counterpoint of that. You actually don't think that this is a high point and you aren't as blown away by.
No, I said I love the Viserys stuff in this episode. All okay,
so but what I'm
going to
say is, do you agree that this is a high point for the series so far? And then furthermore, do you think that this counts as one of the great, you know, not top five, but one of the top Thrones moments of all time?
I think his walk to the throne and his speech at the dinner table in like the next scene. Those are my two favorite parts of this episode and two of the best, you know, character-driven moments of the season.
Okay. All right. Then moving on to that note, later that night at dinner.
I just want to quickly go back. I'm sorry, but how does Vaemond let Daemon bait him into just an absolute death sentence?
You know what? You're right. We absolutely need to talk about the guy getting his head cut in half.
Look, it's just avoidable.
But I think he realizes that he's in a losing spot, and I think he would rather go out on his shield than...
But that's idiotic because you can go back to Driftmark and regroup and plan. You can do
stupid.
Can do
yes. Agreeably stupid. Absolutely.
It's just it made no sense. And like, you know, Daemon is trying to bait you. Also, why turn your back on it? At least like try to put up a fight and be it was just so radically dumb. And I think there for there to be this huge, dramatic, crazy moment that is also badass and shocking. But like, it just rings so hollow to me on like the stupidity intelligence scale.
No, I'm on the same page. I will just say that I love how the VFX team made it so the cut was right above his tongue. That was just so gnarly.
That was well done.
Later that night at dinner, King Viserys gives a moving speech about reuniting the family before departing them for one final time. While the parents take his words to heart, the children don't and continue to squabble. B, you said that you enjoyed this scene the most, so...
Again, it's because of Viserys, and God, it is so utterly nobly sad. You know, he's like, see me as I am, as he takes off his mask and reveals his...
Which is a parallel to Rhaenyra telling Allison as she holds the knife to her neck, now they see you as you are.
Yes, and I would also say, too, that it's a nice kind of counterpoint for Daemon when he's, you know, mutilates the crab feeder, who's, you know, the other kind of mask wearing spectacle in this show. And that is kind of an anger and hatred. And this is a taking off of a mask for someone who also looms large in his life in this moment of extreme vulnerability and in a way power. You know, he's been ineffectual and he tried his best to kind of appease a lot of people rather than maybe lead with some strength, but he is drawing every last ounce of strength and reaching into the depth of his own soul to try to heal this schism within his own family, because he knows, as he says, it's not only it's needed for the realm, but it'll just break this old man's heart if you don't do it.
And just the way that he says it, like the sort of graceful acceptance, like, yo, I'm on the way out. Like, I'm an old man.
He had this disarming self-deprecation. He's like, I'm no longer a handsome man if I ever even was.
And imagine having that sort of humor while you're literally dying.
There is something noble about Viserys.
What do you mean? Of course there is. Because in a universe of people willing to sacrifice their own blood for power, this man was the opposite. And he bent over backwards to appease those he loved at the sacrifice of a stable realm. And that is what's noble about him. And that is why I love this fucking character. And it's true, but
he's
the boy.
Also setting up the realm to be completely chaotic. Right.
But is that, but okay. But that is sort of the ultimate Game of Thrones debate, right? At what point are you willing to sacrifice your soul for this ultimately endless power struggle? And Viserys, look, was he a great king? No, but was he a great man? I think he was. Okay. Did he impregnate like a 13-year-old girl? Yes. But as I say a lot, within the context of medieval times, it's not like that was the way that we think about it today. So that excluded, he strikes me in a Ned Stark way of, and in the same way that we've talked about on the show in our real political worlds, I think politically, they're all out to fuck us. So I try to scope out their quality of character, and Viserys, for all of his political and strategical shortcomings, was a good man. And I'm always going to be attracted to that.
I don't think he should be mentioned in the same breath as Ned Stark in terms of honor.
No, not in terms of heroic honorability, but in terms of decency.
But not even
decency.
Ned wasn't that heroic.
But in terms of decency, in terms of pure decency.
I think he was decent enough for sure. But I think what this episode does so well in the moments that I do like is particularly at this dinner table, it's really seen through the guise of his failing heart and his pain that he harbors because his family is, you know, on the brink of collapse. And yet that is a springboard, a launching pad for the larger conversation and thematic exploration of a divided nation, a power struggle, how, you know, the lust for control can destroy a bloodline. Yet again, it's through his lens, his personal emotional lens of a grandfather, a father, a brother, and a leader trying to make sure everyone's in the best position possible as he departs this world. So that was really well done. I just think, on an overarching level, this was a recreation kind of last week, where it's like, okay, we have serious schisms where people aren't getting along. There's really bad blood between everyone. And ultimately, we don't exit this episode having gotten any real new information. It's just everyone's a little bit older.
We do, though. Allison now has the Song of Ice and Fire.
Sure, but that only puts her back into the position she was at the beginning of this episode. I want the throne. I want my family to continue in power.
Does she want the throne?
Yes.
Okay.
She sits on it like she's damn comfortable.
I mean, I think she's her dad's pawn, but
at the end of the day, but she wants what's still best for her family. And at the end of the day, there's a momentary reprieve. Momentary armistice between the two families. And then we're right back where we kind of started. So I just felt it was a lot of throat clearing. I think some of the age ups will be good though. Aemond, even back, you know, an episode ago, Aegon is a little fuckboy who cares not about honor or duty or familial responsibility. He just wants to drink and hit on women and now sexually assault women. Whereas even as a kid before his eye incident, Aemond seemed like he was more worldly. He was a little bit about the duty. He's like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do within the context of my family. And now he's far more equipped and badass to do those things. So he, even more so than Aegon, seems to be, you know, positioned well for the throne in a sense.
And then final point on this sort of last family dinner is that the eventual Daemon Aemond fight is going to be sick. But I'm also kind of worried, like, unless Daemon's skills have improved over the last few years, Aemond is the better fighter via the transitive property, because Criston Cole beat Daemon in a joust during probably Daemon's prime. And now Aemond is like a 20-year-old, is kind of sunning Cole. So like, while I'm excited for it, I'm also like very worried about it.
Because I think there's a little bit difference between fighting in the tourney grounds and having a little sparring session in the training grounds within the Red Keep. I don't know if either is going 100%, but I don't know. You know, clearly Aemond is a physical threat, clearly.
And there's an obvious like aesthetic parallel between those two, right?
Definitely. And I just want to shout out, because I still can't remember his name, but I mentioned it last episode that the guy playing adult Aemond was a good actor I had seen in something else. And with one eye patched up, still, he shifts his gaze slowly at that dinner. And I'm like, oh, I feel the power. Yeah. I feel the emotion behind that one-eyed shifting gaze.
All right. Final plot beat. In his final moments, confusing Alicent for Rhaenyra, King Viserys tells his wife about the Song of Ice and Fire, therefore mistakenly leading her to believe that it's up to her to unite the kingdom under Aegon's rule.
You blew it!
All right, so as I tweeted, I am absolutely sick about seeing Viserys fumble the ball at the one-yard line after mounting an extraordinary fourth-quarter comeback, all down to a lack of situational awareness and poor clock management. My man, A, needs to know who he's talking to, and B, knows that he's on his last breath before he goes spewing out all of this volatile information. I will say, on my sort of classic Eric emotional beat, the visual of him dying on his own and like reaching out and calling for the love of his life absolutely got me. I think that there is nothing really to delve into, at least from my point of view, about the sort of obviousness of how silly it is that this is all down to the fact that they all have the same fucking names. But B, what is your take on this final scene here?
Man, Viserys is just, he had a tough go of it. For someone who's king, you know, and is better off than 99.9% of the entire realm, he had a really tough go of it. And I'm glad that he gets a little bit of peace, both from his illnesses and from the pressures of you know, ruling the kingdom. And in an alternate world, I would have loved to have seen happier and healthier Viserys had the small council, the great council, chosen Rhaenys to lead in after Jaehaerys, because I think that Viserys lives a fuller life.
All right, then B, unless you have any final thoughts, we'll move on to A Song of Rising and Falling.
Sounds good.
All right, everybody's favorite category of the week, and perhaps in the history of the post-credit podcast, A Song of Rising and Falling. Who are you rooting for this week? Brandon, you're number three.
I'm going to go with lineage, because the whole theme so far of Game of Thrones is that these kids, for the most part, don't really want to be involved in these games. You know, Aegon says he's not going to challenge Rhaenyra because he doesn't really care. He just likes being a rich fuckboy. Luce, when he's talking to Corlys during Lena's funeral, says, I don't want to inherit Driftmark because that means more of my family has died. And yet the parents, the older ones, are the ones that push them into the Game of Thrones and make their lives more dangerous than they have to be, because it is their ambition and fears and insecurities that are driving this. So, you know, now we've seen these kids grow up, they're really stuck in the same cycle. So you have to hope and wonder and pray that eventually there is a generation that is able to break the cycle, much like what Danny wanted to do and failed miserably at.
Wow. So once again, B and I are somewhat on the same train of thoughts, but a bit divergent. This was my number two. I'm going to move it down to number three so we could talk about it at the same time. My number three thing that I am rooting for right now is for all of the adults to live as long as possible, because the entirety of the next generation, particularly Aemon and perhaps excluding Lucerys, seems absolutely reprehensible.
Yeah.
The kids are way worse than the adults. What the fuck are you talking about?
Listen,
yes, it's the adults' fault, but like, what's done is done.
What's done is done, but they all had a chance, you know, particularly when they were younger.
Alicent isn't that old. She's only like 30, 35 years old.
But she's terrible too.
Whoa, I see. Wow. I think that the kids are the fucking like the villains of the show.
I think they're all villains.
All right, B, Song of Rising and Falling, your number two thing, entity, person, plot line that you are rooting for right now.
I think I'm rooting for baby Viserys, because his namesake had a tough go of it. His family is on the verge of civil war. Like, that kid is born into a really, really bad situation, despite being rich and wealthy and powerful. Like, does that baby make it out of babyhood? I don't know.
Well, my number two also has to do with Viserys. It has to do with the adult's dead one and not the baby one. And that is, I am rooting for a peaceful afterlife for Viserys Targaryen, because that guy basically died for like 15 years, which seems pretty terrible. And then slash for Paddy Considine to win an Emmy for Best Supporting Actor, because Best Actor is reserved for our boy Bob Odenkirk. B, the number one character, person, place, thing, verb, et cetera, that you are rooting for in the House of the Dragon world right now is?
I am rooting for the dragons. actually, which seems weird. I've said this before. Every single time they're on screen, I'm just like, God, dragons are so fucking cool. And they are. And that's really cool. But they're also so inherent, not only to old Valyria, but to this era of the Game of Thrones history, and so important in their absence to like the health and the good of the realm, that I just think they're unbelievable for set pieces and so cool as political assets and kind of blue chip prospects. That, I just don't want to see all of them die in the Dance of Dragons.
All right, my number one in A Song of Rising and Falling, who I'm rooting for this week, is Otto Hightower. Look, it was a tough week for Team Green, but I'm dug in at this point. And I've just got to fucking ride it. And look, I have known from the start, this is not going to be a week-by-week winner. But this is, there was a week that he got fired. There was a week that he was not on the show entirely. So this is more of a long play. Bad week for Team Green. They lost Driftmark. Not great. But I do have faith in Otto because Viserys is dead. He seems like the most shrewd one prepared to pounce on that.
And I'm excited to see how Corlys comes back. I would be surprised if like they open next week and he's like, oh, he's dead. I would be surprised.
Yeah. All right. With that is the end of this week's episode. Thank you, as always, to my boy Cade for joining me as co-host. Thank you to Brandon, our halfway house of a co-host, for joining me. Follow Brandon at @great_Catsby and see all the good work he's doing at Parrot Analytics. Follow Cade at @Cade_Onder and all of his work at comicbook.com. Follow me at Eric Italiano and at PostgredPod. Keep an eye out for our interview with the one and only The Rock. I will pipe in some if you some mail, and we will talk to you guys next week. Peace.
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.